Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning and welcome to the final day of the March term of court of the South Dakota Supreme Court held here at the University of South Dakota School of Law. We would like to welcome schools from Elk Point, Hurley, Beresford, Centerville, Butte, and Bonesteel. If you haven't already had an opportunity to, there are synopses available on the table in the lobby as you come in, and these would give you a brief summary of each one of the oral argument cases we are considering this term, tells you a little bit about ourselves, and also our arguments are now carried live on the internet and also archived on the internet on our homepage. So if you see a case in the future that catches your interest that's going to be argued in front of this court, you have the opportunity to either listen to it live or at your convenience when it's been archived. And if you look on page 35 of that synopsis, it will give you the website for our Unified Judicial System and allow you then to listen to those cases on the internet. The first case for argument this morning is in the interest of T.A., Mr. George F. Johnson, for the appellants A.L. and J.L., an attorney from Gregory, and Ms. Kirsten Jasper, for the appellee State of South Dakota, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre, and Ms. Anita, is it Foose? Foose, okay, I guessed right, for the appellee Child. Now, my understanding is, Ms. Jasper, you'll have 15 minutes, and Ms. Foose, you'll have 5, is that correct? With Ms. Jasper going first? All right. All right, Mr. Johnson, you may proceed, sir.
Please, the court, counsel. This is a child abuse case, and particularly it's a spanking case, and I guess we're here today to argue about when does spanking go from being legal corporal punishment to being illegal child abuse. And I think as I begin, I'd like to talk about some of the things that this case is not about to give the court a better understanding. It's not about a three-year-old baby who was spanked bare-bottomed with a belt 40 to 50 times. This is a case about a 12-year-old boy who was spanked while wearing jeans 8 to 10 times. This is not a case about a child who was spanked for no reason whatsoever. This is a case about a 12-year-old who had been misbehaving, had been highly erratic both at school and at home for 3 months leading up to the spanking on October 6, 2001. It was on that day, October 6, 2001, that his behavior was especially bad. It crescendoed at the end of the night where he totally lost control of his behavior and his stepfather implemented corporal punishment and he spanked him. That was October 6, 2001. We sit here today, over 1 year, 6 months later, and that child has still not been returned to the home. There is still the possibility that his parental rights could be terminated.
My understanding was we authorized the return of that child.
You authorized and gave the trial court jurisdiction, Your Honor, and the hearing is set for next week.
All right, thank you.
That was as soon as we could get the hearing.
But there is a recommendation from the department that he be returned home, is that?
I believe so, Your Honor. Anyway, we're a long ways removed from that case, and here we sit today, and now I want to talk to you about what I believe are the 6 major mistakes that the trial court made. The first one occurred before trial even started. I had filed several motions in limine that would have greatly reduced the scope of the trial and the scope of the evidence at trial. When I got ready to go to trial that on the day of trial, I look on my fax machine, and there sits an amended petition, which had cured almost all of the errors that I had pointed out in my motions in limine. And this, again, was on the day of trial. So I drive to trial, and I get there and I object to the amendment of the petition at such a late date.
Why would you object to an amendment if it gave you what you were asking for?
It didn't, Your Honor. It allowed the state to add more claims and expand the scope of what the evidence was going to be at trial. So it totally worked against me. And so the trial court concluded that she could allow amendment of the petition as long as justice so required, and she could do it to conform to the evidence. Well, we hadn't started trial yet, and so there was no evidence to conform to. And given that it was my clients had their parental rights on the line, I don't know how it could be in the interest of justice that they be allowed to add new claims and new allegations on the day of trial.
But you were given the chance to have a continuance, were you not, so that you could prepare for the changes?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. We did not exercise that option because we had all of our witnesses there. We were prepared to do that trial in one day. Some of those witnesses were there from out of state. One of them was an unpaid expert who was there from out of state who had missed work to be there. And we felt like we had no choice but to proceed and take on the claims as they might be. The added claims were, by the way, dismissed by directed verdict. But we still had to fight them, and it's still prejudicial to us to have to fight them because it expanded the scope of the evidence greatly. The second major mistake that the trial court made occurred, and it regarded an evidentiary issue, and it was about some pictures that were introduced. I had requested those pictures prior to the second day of the adjudicatory hearing in writing. Now, the state didn't turn them over to me, and I was entitled to them under 26-7A-60, which says in these child abuse cases, they're required to give me all pictures and tangible evidence if I request them in writing, which I did twice. And I entered my letters requesting them into evidence. The trial judge concluded that the evidence was admissible, and she started to apply a Rule 403 analysis. And I told her, I said, Judge, I'm not objecting to these on a relevancy grounds. I was entitled to have them as a discovery, under discovery. And then she said, well, they haven't violated any discovery orders. And I said, you're correct, but they have violated this statute that says I was entitled to this stuff. Now, those pictures were relied upon heavily by their so-called expert, and I'll tell you why she's so-called in just a second, but and then relied upon heavily in the judge's final verdict when she decided that TA had been an abused and neglected child.
Well, wasn't there oral testimony and described the nature of the injury? Aren't the pictures merely cumulative to that oral testimony?
There was some testimony on that, Your Honor, but it wasn't very descriptive. And I think the pictures were prejudicial. The fact of the matter is, Your Honor,
Are you saying that they're inaccurate or somehow?
No, I'm not even saying that they shouldn't have come in. Had they given them to me, Your Honor, I think they were probably the evidence of the case. They showed bruises. The fact of the matter is, though, I needed them so I could take them over to my doctor and say, Doc, help me with these. What do you see here? Help me prepare so I can cross-examine their expert. And I even explained that in one of my letters, that the pictures weren't for me. They were for my expert to help me prepare. And they wouldn't give them to me. And that's why I think I was prejudiced on that point.
Now, the state alleges in its brief that you were given the opportunity to view the pictures before the hearing. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Well, then what's the harm here? If you saw the pictures and knew what was on them, you certainly had the opportunity to use them in any way that you wanted to.
And that's not correct. I went days before the trial began and fought like the dickens to get those pictures from the hospital. First, they wouldn't give them to me because they said I wasn't a lawyer. Second, they wouldn't give them to me because they said I didn't have an authorized release, which I did, in fact, have, and went and got it signed and got it. Then they wouldn't give it to me because they didn't have permission from the prosecutor, so I had Pam Ireland, who was the prosecutor, call up there and give them permission. Then they wouldn't give them to me because they didn't believe that that was Pam Ireland. Finally, they gave me the pictures, but they would not let me take them out of the hospital because it was part of their hospital records. So I had seen them, but again, they weren't for me when I requested them in writing. They were for my doctor so he could see them and that's why we were prejudiced. The third reason, the third major mistake that the trial judge made goes to their expert, or their so-called expert, who was a PA by the name of Diane Krantz. She testified when I voir-dired her. I made a foundation objection, which was overruled. I then voir-dired the witness, even though it was during their direct, and she flatly and plainly admitted that she was not an expert in the medical field. Now, that should have been the end of the inquiry right there, and those opinions should not have come in. But the judge overruled that objection. So we went on a little further. During cross-examination, the witness, P.A. Krantz, admitted that she had conducted no tests whatsoever in coming to her conclusions. So I made a motion under Daubert and its progeny and said, Judge, you need to have reliable tests, you need to have reliable facts, and you need to end up with reliable results. And the judge said, well, Daubert just doesn't apply in this case. And that was what she said. And as you know, Daubert does apply to medical opinions in this state. And so I think it was prejudicial for her to allow those opinions, and then she relied upon them in her findings of fact and conclusions of law. The fifth, and maybe the most important major error that the trial court made has to do with a motion to bifurcate that I filed. That came about because during the second day of the adjudicatory hearing, the trial court announced that after the defense rested, the child's court-appointed attorney was going to be allowed to put on her own case in chief. I filed a motion to bifurcate, and I argued numerous points, including that, one, it was going to confuse the issues. The issues were only two in this whole thing. One, had the state proven by clear and convincing evidence that TA was an abused and neglected child? And if so, the second question was, what would be in his best interest in the future?
Well, this was a court trial. You're not implying that the trial court would be confused when the trial court had set up its own procedure, are you?
Well, I am, I guess, Your Honor, because they're two different topics. One of them is to deal with the best interest of the child, and one of them is to deal with whether the state had proved their case by clear and convincing evidence. Now, under when they're doing the dispositional hearing, the court can hear all types of hearsay, can consider all types of evidence that it wants. It crafts its own rules during the dispositional hearing. During the adjudicatory hearing, though, it's required to follow the rules of civil procedure. And when the trial court allowed the child's attorney to put on its own case in chief after we had rested, she went to and acted like it was a dispositional hearing where she was allowing hearsay, where she was allowing evidence that was totally unrelated and prejudicial, and it was evidence about what would be in TA's best interest if we lost.
Is there any evidence in the record that the trial court considered improper evidence in making the decision? I mean, we say all the time that the trial courts, we presume, are going to follow the rules of evidence, consider what's admissible, and discard the rest. I mean, are there findings of fact that are based on improper evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
What are they?
Well, just one example that comes to mind is that during the child's attorney's case in chief, they entered a statement from my client that was made in the days following the spanking. In that statement, he referred to spanking as beatings and whoopings, and he's a trucker and a veteran and a farmer, and he doesn't speak politically correct, but they use those against him, and they show up in the findings of facts, statements that he made in that statement that never would have been into evidence had they not had they granted my motion to bifurcate.
But it was admissible evidence on the issue of whether or not abuse had in fact occurred.
Well, Your Honor, that may have been true had the state offered it, but the state had already rested at that point. And
well, no matter who offered it, the evidence was admissible of whether abuse had occurred in the past. Am I right?
No, Your Honor, you're wrong. Because at that point, the state had rested and we had a directed verdict on any allegations of previous spankings. So that issue was dead by the time that this got introduced. And so I wouldn't say it would be admissible.
But the state could have admitted it. The state could have put it in their case.
Theoretically, I objected to it and said it was cumulative but theoretically, the state could have done it, had they so chosen to. They didn't.
When the judge went into this, allowed the testimony from the child's attorney, was there an indication at that time in the proceedings that this was all the evidence at that point forward was going to the adjudicatory phase of it?
Well, that's part of why I say there's a lot of confusion about this, Your Honor. There was no clear definition about whether she was moving on to the dispositional hearing or she was staying in the adjudicatory hearing. I pointed out to her that you cannot move on to the dispositional hearing until you have a ruling on the adjudicatory hearing. And she still allowed the child's attorney to present evidence. And some of it was best interest evidence, and some of it was evidence that went towards whether they were responsible or not.
So at least portions of it were toward the adjudicatory phase, as
yes.
opposed to the dispositional.
And as the court will note, if you read their briefs, the state's brief and the child's brief, they don't even agree about whether we were still in the dispositional hearing or whether we were in the adjudicatory hearing. Ms. Foos says we were still in the adjudicatory hearing and that she had every right to present a case in chief. And I'm not here saying that she didn't have the right to present a case in chief. That's not my position. My position is that she shouldn't have been allowed to present that case in chief after the defense had rested, because it left a great many unknowns for me. I had to present everything I had for fear. I didn't know what she was going to present. There's no discovery in these. And so I had to call my clients as witnesses, even though I didn't think that the state had proven their case, and I could have sat down right then.
After the child's case rested, did you have an opportunity to rebut if you wished?
I did, Your Honor, but it was the type of best interest information that I didn't want to rebut because we weren't at that stage of the game. We weren't, in my mind, we weren't supposed to be considering what was in the best interest of the trial during that hearing, and so it was unnecessary for me to rebut.
Now, this took place over, what, about three different time frames? Different days over a period of time?
Two dates in November and then one date, I believe, in January.
And none of them were designated adjudicatory as opposed to dispositional. Is that correct?
It was my understanding that it was all adjudicatory because they had not decided the first issue, which is whether my clients were responsible for child abuse.
I thought I read in the brief from the appellee that there was an order entered at some point by the court that they were adjudicated.
They were. 6 months after the adjudicatory hearing ended, the trial court finally entered an order and found TA to be abused and neglected, and then we had a dispositional hearing after that.
So there was no ruling from the bench at any time either?
No, ma'am.
Correct?
Which leads me to why I think the trial court made its fifth major mistake, and that's a sufficiency of the evidence argument. And as I've argued in my brief, all the state proved is, by clear and convincing evidence anyway, is that TA was spanked, and that's a fact that we have admitted from the very inception of this case, and two, that TA had bruises. Now, even their expert couldn't say what caused those bruises. Furthermore, there was no evidence whatsoever regarding how much force would be needed to cause a bruise on TA. And I think that is an extremely, extremely important point, because if it turns out that TA is one of those children, not so rare children, that bruises very easily, the fact that he had bruises would mean nothing with regard to how much force was used.
Was there medical evidence that he does bruise easily?
There was no evidence with that regard, Your Honor. In fact, I see in one of their briefs they argued that, well, the fact that he still had bruises 4 days after the spanking proves that it was unreasonable in force. Well, as I pointed out in my reply, the child had fallen over a piece of farm equipment days before the spanking took place, and he still had bruises on his thighs from that, which would be 8 days removed. So all it really proved is that once he bruises, he stays bruised for a long time.
Did the child give an opinion about how he thought these bruises occurred?
That's a good question, Your Honor. He allegedly told the PA that the bruises were caused during the spanking. He did not testify at trial. So he did not come to trial and say, He was spanking me very hard, and he was spanking me way too much, and he was spanking me for no good reason. One thing that I can tell you about what he told the PA. In this case, it all began because on his thigh, right thigh, he had a bruise about the size of a football. And that's why they filed the original petition that says he's got a huge bruise on his right thigh, and that proves child abuse. During trial, my expert testified to a reasonable medical probability that that bruise was not caused by a belt. We offered testimony that he had fallen off his bike that same day as the spanking and fallen on his right hip off a bike ramp, and the trial judge concluded that that particular bruise, the big one that started the whole thing, was not caused by the spanking. And so I think that that makes it clear that things that TA may have told the PA, he was either confused or mistaken, but he told her that that big bruise was caused by the spanking, and he was wrong about that. I'll just spend a few minutes talking about a few of the things that we proved during trial with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence argument.
Before you do that,
okay,
if the parents come on and testify to the effect that whatever beatings were administered were necessary because of the conduct of the child, shouldn't the child, in his own defense, have the right to testify and to present evidence to the effect that that's not necessarily true? These beatings far exceeded what was necessary for discipline.
I believe he had that right, absolutely, Your Honor. And we fully expected the state to present that evidence. The child was never called to testify. The only testimony about how hard TA was spanked was testimony by the stepfather, who said, I had him, I rolled him over, I was on my knees, I folded over my belt, did not use the belt buckle, spanked him 8 to 10 times, about half as hard as I could. A reasonable amount, I would say. And if that was not true, they certainly could have called in TA to come in and rebut that testimony and say, it was more than 8 to 10 times. It was incredibly hard, and they had no good cause to do it. They didn't do that. But I fully agree with you, they had that right.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Jasper, you have 15 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. I'm Kirsten Jasper, and I'm representing the state in this matter. This is a case about parents who took unreasonable actions in disciplining their child. And I will take the appellant's arguments as they presented them. First, with the last issue he stated in his brief regarding the amended petition, the trial court is well within their discretion to amend petitions at any point during the trial, and that is only to be overturned by clear and convincing evidence that it was, or by a clear abuse of that discretion.
You might move the mic a little closer to you. Okay.
Is that better?
Yes.
That's better.
Sorry. A trial court's ruling on the amended petition should only be overturned if there's a clear abuse of discretion. In this case, if there was error, which the state does not argue there was in allowing the amended petition, the parents were offered a continuance on that issue and declined to take the continuance. Also, by their motions in limine, they showed that they were prepared to argue the issues that were added into the amended petition, which involved more or less the bruises that appeared on the child when he was first discovered. As parents' attorney stated, there was one large bruise on his thigh. The day after the original petition was filed, there were more bruises discovered on his buttocks as well as on his wrists and his upper forearms. But they were allowed a continuance and it was denied. As to the second issue that parents argue regarding the pictures, state's exhibits 7 through 16 that were admitted, they were again, without stating that there was error in the discovery process, the state does not concede that there was. The trial court is allowed certain remedies, and one of those remedies is a continuance, which the Parents were offered a continuance in order to have their expert examine those pictures and then recall their expert to testify, which did occur in the trial. The Dr. Knecht was recalled, did examine the pictures, and testified to them.
Is there any explanation that the state has on why these pictures weren't turned over at the appropriate time?
My understanding from the record was that Martin does not have the ability to copy reproduced pictures in a manner like at Kinko's or something to that effect. That's all that I could glean from the record.
Did the state have copies of the pictures in their own file?
I don't know, sir. My understanding would be from reading the record that they only used the pictures that were in the medical file at the hospital.
You're only handling the appeal. You didn't handle the trial court work?
Correct. As to the third issue regarding the opinion of Diane Krantz.
Back to the pictures, excuse me. I mean, these were really the basic evidentiary item, were they not? I mean, you can testify about these bruises, but unless, as a court, looking at them, I mean, this would be a very important piece of the evidence not to provide the parents in order to prepare to deal with it, isn't? Wouldn't you say that those pictures were an integral part of the state's case?
There was testimony regarding the extent of the bruising as well as the medical report that was written up by Diane Krantz regarding that.
But this case hinges on how severe those bruises were. Isn't that correct? I mean, that's what we're here about. Were these sufficient? Were they bruises? Were they from the spanking? And how serious were they? That's the bottom line here, isn't it?
That's very much part of the case, as well as the other circumstances as to why the child was beat with a belt and other issues that revolve around that. But yes, pictures were probably very important as the visualization of what the bruises were and what they looked like. But the parents were offered the right to have a continuance and recall their expert, which they did to testify to those pictures. And when he testified to those pictures, he did, as far as the bruising along the buttocks and along the belt line, where stepfather admitted when he whipped the child with a belt, that he hit one time at least above the belt line, above where the jeans covered. And at that point in time, there was a separate bruise, and he admitted that he probably caused that bruise above the belt line in his own testimony. And the parents' doctor at that time also testified that he believed those linear bruises that appeared on the child's buttocks as well as above the belt line were a result or were consistent with being spanked with a belt. Moving into the opinion then of Diane Krantz, the trial court again has discretion in determining whether or not expert testimony is credible, and it should only be overturned if there's a clear abuse of that discretion. In this case, the trial court did find that Ms. Krantz's testimony was credible based on her experience and knowledge in the area of blunt force trauma. This court has decided in Garland versus Rosnick that Daubert is a general guide as far as medical expertise goes, but not to be applied in all settings. Further, in this case, there was no prejudicial effect were Ms. Krantz's testimony not admitted as far as her opinions regarding the bruises because of the testimony of Dr. Knecht, the parents' own doctor, who testified that the bruises were consistent with being spanked with a belt, as well as the other bruises on the upper arm and the forearm that he testified were consistent with either grasping the child's wrist as well as holding the child down with his hands. Moving into
how large a child was this? Is there anything?
He was a 12-year-old child.
So,
I would assume probably average. I don't know. I do believe there is a picture in the record that is a more of a full body shot for the court's reference in that question. Moving into the point of error in the motion to bifurcate, the state's position would be that the trial court is provided with broad discretion in structuring these proceedings so that they are in the best interest of the child, and it would be in the best interest of the child that all evidence regarding the abuse and neglect would be presented at the trial during the trial phase. Further, the parents were offered prior to when they put in their motion to limit our motion to bifurcate, they were offered the chance to rebut any evidence presented by the child's attorney. They did not, at the end of the trial, they did not present any rebuttal evidence whatsoever. Further, there would have been no error in any of the evidence that the child presented. Most of the testimony presented by the child was regarding the character of the child and how he was doing in his foster care placement, how he did in school regarding his behaviors, going towards his character, saying that he was not a child that was frequently out of control. Were that testimony not presented, there still would have been more than sufficient evidence to adjudicate the child abused and neglected due to the stepfather's own admissions in his testimony at trial. And getting to the last issue brought by opposing counsel this morning as to the insufficiency of the evidence. The trial court is given great deference in their findings of fact. And in this case, the trial court, when adjudicating child abuse and neglected, found that stepfather administered corporal punishment, which consisted of whipping the child with a belt 8 to 10 times. That stepfather forced child face down onto a mattress and held him there whilst banking him with the belt. And in doing so, he had to grab the child's wrist and turn him around. Further, the court found that stepfather beat child with the belt until child completely relaxed. Stepfather also used the belt due to a buildup of the child's character over a period of 3 months preceding the spanking. The stepfather admitted to Officer McMillan that at the time he whipped the child with the belt that he was riled. The trial court further found that the parents tried no other disciplinary tactic on October 6, 2001, and that the first disciplinary act that they administered that day was the whipping of the child with the belt 8 to 10 times. Child's sister, the trial court found, heard the striking of the belt on the child and the child crying from another room. The trial court also found that the corporal punishment went beyond that of what would be considered reasonable and was abusive. And it was the evidence that the trial court said supported this finding was the stepfather's testimony that he gave the child an attitude adjustment, the bruises on the child's buttocks and belt line that were testified as being consistent with that of being hit by a belt, as exhibited in State's Exhibits 7, 10, 12, and 13. Also, the bruises on child's wrist and forearms that the child said he got in by trying to protect himself from being hit by the belt. The expert further testified that Dr. Kinnack did not examine the child and only examined pictures that he testified were of poor quality. Therefore, his testimony was not as weighty as that is the physician's assistant who personally examined the child and saw the bruises on his body. Further, the trial court did find that the large bruise on child's right thigh was not consistent with a belt spanking, and the state at no point in this appeal is arguing that it is. The trial court did find that the bruises on the buttocks, the wrists, and the arms were a result of the belt spanking or forcing the child down onto the mattress as well. This court, in order to overturn these findings of fact, must be left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. The child has not shown any, or the parents have not shown that a mistake has been made. Stepfather's own testimony at the trial or at the hearing supplies that. He states himself that he admitted spanking the child 8 to 10 times with a belt, that he did not quit whipping the child until the child quit fighting, that once he hit the child above the belt line and he probably caused that bruise. He further testified that he grabbed the child's wrist, and he also testified that he probably caused the bruise that resulted on the child's wrist. Mother also admitted that she was aware of the type of discipline that father used and agreed with it and did not intervene in the child being disciplined in such an unreasonable manner. Further, this court, as to the argument regarding whether or not there must be credible, the medical evidence must be with medical certainty, this court has found in the interest of MW that where a physician has testified that the bruises caused on the child were consistent with blunt trauma, has upheld that as sufficient evidence to adjudicate a child abused and neglected. Also, in State versus Augustine, this court determined that a physician who examined the father and examined the daughter in that case and testified that he could not say with medical certainty that the marks on the child were caused by a cigarette burn. But
you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. The physician did testify, however, that those marks were consistent with being burned with a cigarette, and the court upheld that conviction of child abuse on a higher burden of proof, that being by beyond a reasonable doubt, where here we only have the burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence.
Do you believe that there needs to be an expert to testify about those bruises, or is that something within the knowledge of a judge or common ordinary person to be able to determine? Does the state have to present an expert?
I don't know that a state has to present an expert, but it's certainly very helpful in cases of child abuse and neglect, and it is the state's attorney's choice as far as their strategy and how they want to present the case. The parents attempt to justify their actions by claiming that the child was out of control on the day in question. There was no testimony by any of the other members that were in the household, and there were quite a few other than father and stepfather and mother, that the child was out of control that day. What instigated the spanking was that child was asked to go over to the new home, which was directly across from the old home that they were moving into, to grab a trash can. He came back over to the new home with the trash can, threw the trash can on the floor. Stepfather said, you know better than that. He went back, he picked up the trash can, set it the right way, and was headed back to the room when his stepsister walked in and said, child spilled garbage on the old kitchen floor in the old home and did not pick it up and throw it away.
Does the state dispute that evidence?
As far as what occurred on that morning, I don't believe there's any testimony.
That he dumped the garbage in the old house and then brought it over to the new house?
I think what was stated was that the garbage was spilled in the old house. Whether he dumped it or it accidentally spilled, I don't believe there's any testimony.
Do they have any evidence to support that supposition?
As far as whether it was dumped or spilled?
Yeah, or that it just happened?
There was no evidence in regard to that.
He's the only one who went over to get the garbage, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Okay. So was he out of control or wasn't he?
The state says that he wasn't. The testimony when he was back at the home was that he was listening to father and was headed back to his bedroom when stepfather found out what happened in the
old
home.
What evidence did the state put on that that's true?
That he was not out of control?
Right, that he was returning to his bedroom as an obedient boy.
I won't say that he was told to go to his bedroom. What was stated by stepfather's testimony is that after he corrected the trash can, he was headed towards his room. Stepsister, who reported the trash can incident at the old home, stated that he was headed back to his room at the time she entered. Another gentleman that was in the home, Ray Mansfield, testified that he set the trash can right, was headed back to his room. That was the testimony at the trial court proceedings. There was no testimony that was screaming by any other members or persons in the household. There was no testimony that his arms were flailing around at the time.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Lewis, you have 5 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Anita Foose. I'm an attorney in Myrtle, and I was appointed to represent TA, the minor child, in this case. I would like to speak to the denial of the parents' motion, which was identified as a motion to bifurcate. First, I'd like to submit that this motion was not really a motion to bifurcate evidence, as the parents claimed at the time. The intent of that motion was to preclude the child's attorney from introducing evidence at the adjudicatory hearing. If you review the transcript arguments on pages 324 to 337, it makes it clear that the intent of the parents was that the child should not be allowed to introduce any evidence at all. They wanted to limit the child's introduction of evidence to the dispositional hearing. Parents claimed that the child had no place in an adjudicatory hearing. However, Justice Sabers, as you said, in the interest of HM and SM, generally during the adjudicatory phase, the well-being of the child is directly at risk. That intent, interest of the child, and its importance was recognized by the legislature in their procedural statutes. SDCL 26-8A-18 requires the court to appoint an attorney for any child alleged to be abused or neglected in any judicial proceeding to represent the child's interest. 26-8A-20 says if the child has been adjudicated and is removed from the home, then the court shall appoint a guardian ad litem or special advocate to assist the child's attorney. The legislature must have intended that the attorney participate in the adjudicatory hearings. Otherwise, they would not have provided this two-step procedure for appointing representatives for the child. So, the next question is, what role is the child's attorney to play in an adjudicatory hearing? That the legislature intended that this role would include presenting a case in chief can be seen by the discovery procedures in the Juvenile Code. Specifically, SDCL 26-7A-69 gives the state's attorney a right to access to certain evidence which the respondent or the child intends to introduce as evidence in chief, or which was prepared by a witness whom the respondent or the child intends to call. There's also case law supporting this conclusion that the child is allowed to participate fully in the adjudicatory hearing. In the interest of PM, the Supreme Court heard an appeal by the child of a dismissal of an ANN petition. In that case, the state and the child had originally appealed. The state dropped out of the appeal for reasons unknown, and the child continued with the appeal. The Supreme Court sided with the child and reversed the trial court's decision dismissing the petition. Also, in the matter of AM.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Before you finish your remarks, isn't the real issue here, though, just simply whether you introduced dispositional evidence at the adjudicatory stage of this proceeding?
I think that is one of the issues, and my argument is that I did not introduce any dispositional evidence. I fully believed that that was the adjudicatory hearing. I fully believed that I had the right and the duty to introduce adjudicatory evidence. The stepfather had claimed, and the mother had both claimed, that the child, by eliciting statements during the state's case in chief as well as during their case in chief, that the child was totally out of control, basically a bad kid, could not be controlled unless the stepfather beat him with a belt. And my evidence was intended to directly counter that assertion to establish that there were other means of disciplining the child. And as a result, the force used by the stepfather in this case was neither reasonable in manner nor moderate in degree, as asserted by the parents. In the matter of AM, Supreme Court reversed a dismissal of an ANN petition. They said in that case that it was error for the appellant, for the trial court not to allow the appellants, plural, to introduce certain evidence. The appellants in that case were identified as both the state and the child, making it clear that the Supreme Court in that case thought that the child had a right to introduce evidence. And let me say, it's not also not sufficient to protect the child's interest to limit them to just questioning witnesses that are put on by other parties. There is evidence that the child's attorney may be aware of that the other parties do not have, that they have not requested. There may be other directions that the child wants to go. Sometimes the child's interest is not the same as the state's.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Johnson, you challenged the sufficiency of the evidence, and the trial court made finding of fact number 8, which basically provides that Jerry administered corporal punishment by hitting TA with a belt several times. Jerry's not sure how many times he hit TA, but he estimated 8 to 10 times. Jerry had TA lie face down on the mattress of his bed. Jerry admitted to the deputy sheriff that he had to use force to get TA to face down on the mattress because TA was fighting him. Jerry admitted that he got his TA's arm forced and forced him over onto the mattress. Jerry held TA down and hit him 8 to 10 times with the belt that he doubled over. And you've previously stated that he hit him half as hard as he could. And Jerry did not hit him with the belt buckle, but with the looped side of the belt. Jerry admits that while he was hitting TA on the buttocks with the belt, TA tried to squirm away and Jerry hit him too high, and the belt hit TA's lower back. Jerry says he apologized to TA for hitting him too high. During the beating, TA was wearing jeans. Jerry testified that when he administers corporal punishment with the belt, he continues to hit TA until TA relaxes and Jerry had control over him again. Is there any one of those findings contained within that finding number 8 that are not substantiated by the record?
Well, Your Honor, I did file quite a few objections to those findings of fact, which were ignored. But the fact of the matter is that that's basically what happened. He took him back, he restrained him, he spanked him, and pursuant to SDCL 22-18-5, a parent in this state has the right to control and restrain their child as long as they're doing so in a reasonable manner and doing it with a reasonable degree. And I guess where I differ is where the court throws in that he was beat. And, you know, the court all along has used that term. It was just corporal punishment to get him back under control, which it did.
So you say that even though that's the case, there's enough procedural errors here, though, so that you should get a new it should be sent back and you should get a new trial?
Your Honor,
how would you change the result in your mind?
Well, I just don't think that there was sufficient evidence to prove by clear and convincing evidence that any of those bruises, for one, were caused by during the spanking, and except for the one that he has admitted he probably caused the one, and he went back then and said and apologized to him about it. He says, "I only spanked you on the butt. I'm sorry." But I think just because he spanked, there is no statute in the state that says you can't spank. There is a statute that says you can correct or restrain. And so I think if we make a per se rule that spanking is automatically child abuse here, we're going down a slippery slope.
Well, is spanking all automatically defined as wrapping a belt around your hand and hitting somebody half as hard as you can?
No.
Or is that closer to a beating?
I think a beating is, it comes down to how hard you're hitting and what the condition. You got to look at the totality of the circumstances. What did he do wrong? What was he wearing? How old is the boy? What amount of force was used? You got to look at all of it. And in this case, we presented evidence that it was half as hard as it was supposed to be and that there was conditions and that he was 12 years old, and they didn't come back and rebut any of that stuff.
Does the record indicate the size of the boy?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
Does the record indicate the size of the stepfather?
No, it does not. The record does not.
Okay.
Following up on those questions, isn't it true, as I read the record, it appears that part of the reason the stepfather gave for this, for the spanking, was for conduct that had occurred up to three months prior to this incident? Is that reasonable to use a belt for something that happened 3 months before the spanking?
Your Honor, let me make 2 points on that question. First of all, we had an expert come in and testify, having known Tim her whole life, having been an expert in child psychology and all that good stuff, that under some circumstances, under this particular facts, she thought it was reasonable. They didn't bring an expert in to say that that wasn't right. The second thing is, he's not saying, he never did say, well, it was something that occurred 3 months ago that I'm spanking him for. He's saying it was a culmination. He got back from his biological father's, and from that point on, for 3 months, his behavior was erratic and was uncontrolled from time to time, both at home and at school, and then it all culminated in that one day. But he was saying he would repeatedly warn him during that 3 months. You're getting close. You're going to need an attitude adjustment, i.e. a spanking. And so it wasn't one thing that happened 3 months before. It was a culmination of all those things. And I think under those circumstances, the spanking was reasonable.
Say that the court agrees with you on your claims that there were six errors. Where do we go from here? Are you entitled to a new trial, outright acquittal, or where are we at?
I contend we're entitled to an outright acquittal, Your Honor. I don't think the trial was fundamentally fair. And under the United States Supreme Court case I cited to you, if they're going to try to mess with family bonds, if the state is, they've got to provide a fair trial. And I think if you look at all six of those errors, those major errors, in one group and say, you just can't say that they got a fair trial. And so I think that that in itself would require just a reversal. But with regard to the bifurcation issue and the insufficiency of the evidence issue, I think that those require not just reversal, but total dismissal of the case. Now, those evidence issues, they may require just a reversal. But if I'm asking the court to look at all the errors and try to determine whether my client's got a fair trial and not just look at one of them at a time. With regard to the bruises, you know, been a lot of talk that he had bruises on his butt and on his legs and on his arms. It's undisputed testimony that days before the spanking took place, T.A. was running across the yard in the dark and tripped over a plow and got bruises on his legs. Now, I don't know whether that caused bruises on his arms or not. Nobody does. It's undisputed testimony that the day before the spanking, he fell off his skateboard at least twice. Undisputed. Don't know whether he fell on his butt, whether he fell on his arms. Nobody does. Undisputed that on the day of the spanking, he fell off his bike, off a bike ramp, and landed on his back hip. Don't know whether he also fell on his arms and that caused some of those bruises. Nobody does. The fact of the matter is that both of the experts testified they didn't know what caused those bruises. So how can the judge enter those findings of fact and conclusions of law and say by clear and convincing evidence that those bruises were caused during the spanking? Nobody can say that. At best, they reached preponderance of the evidence, but they didn't reach clear and convincing. Now, she cited matter of AM. Now, that's a case involving a three-month-old baby that got punched in the face, and in that case, the court basically said under these facts, bruises mean abuse. But it didn't say in every case bruises mean abuse, and that would be incredibly ridiculous to think that because all kids bruise differently, and that you got to consider all the facts of why they're being restrained and corrected. And so I would ask the court not to go down that road.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
With regard to their expert's testimony, they said, their expert got up and admitted just point blank, I am not an expert in the medical field. According to Garland, which this court decided, the fundamental baseline for reliability of an expert is that they only offer expert opinions in their field of expertise. Now, I'm not saying Diane Krantz doesn't have expertise in other fields, but she admitted she wasn't an expert in this field, and that should have been the end of that. With regard to whether T.A. was out of control that night after he got accused of throwing the trash can, the evidence was, yes, he came in, he threw the trash can, went back and picked it up, then started heading toward the bedroom, as she asserted. But it was at that point that the sister came in and tattled on him. And then he flew into his screaming denial and yelling denial. And I guess what she's saying is only the stepfather was the one that testified about that. Well, they didn't bring anybody in to rebut that testimony. So it stands by itself. And that's why he took him back. He was out of control, and he took him back, and he used corporal punishment to get him back under control, which is his right. With regard to what Ms. Fuchs is saying, I wasn't trying to preclude her from introducing evidence on the child's behalf. What I was saying is, don't do it after we have rested, when we don't know what kind of evidence you're going to try to produce. She's saying she intended it to be adjudicatory-style evidence. Well, if I don't know what that is, how can I fully rest my case? It's given the state two bites at the apple because every motion, every argument we had, she joined the state with and has done so on this appeal. And so it was like the state got to go, then I got to go, and then the state got to go. And that just wasn't fair. With regard to the constitutionality...
Your time has expired, Counselor. Thank you. We will be in recess for 10 minutes.